The transition from hunting and gathering to agriculture is arguably the most important event in human prehistory, representing a shift from foraging to farming, from food collection to food production, from wild to domestic, that sets the stage for most of the significant subsequent developments in human society. For this reason, the beginnings of agriculture have been the subject of scholarly interest since at least the middle of the last century, as evidenced by Charles Darwin's 1868 treatise on the variation of plants and animals under domestication, and subsequent works by many other authors.
As it turns out, tracing that key event, the beginning of agriculture in Europe, is also rather tricky. What have we been able to find out in the past few years? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
What are the repercussions of moving from a hunting or foraging way of life to an agricultural existence? Were there any farmers who reverted to hunting and foraging? What conditions made farming possible, and once it began, how fast did it spread through Europe? Our guest is T. Douglas Price, professor of European archaeology and director of the Laboratory for Archaeological Chemistry at the UW-Madison.
Well, welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you.
I'm thinking as we're talking about the origins of agriculture that maybe we should get a definition of agriculture because, let's say, I'm growing a tomato plant for myself. Is that agriculture?
Well, the origins of agriculture have a lot more to do with changes in society than they do really in what people were eating. They have a lot to do with numbers of people coming to live together permanently in one place. They have a lot to do with transformations in religious belief and activity, which becomes much more apparent. They have a lot to do with economic exchange. It's a complete change in human society that takes place over the last 10,000 years. And I think those consequences of domesticating plants and animals are really what we talk about when we talk about agriculture.
And it seems that the more information we get sometimes, the more confused the picture gets, just when we think we have things sort of figured out, oh, here's something that doesn't fit.
That's for sure. I mean, the good part of that, it means we can always ask new questions and get more money to do research, hopefully. But it's certainly true that as we learn more, things do become more complicated. And that's a consequence of what we're dealing with, really. We're looking at materials that have survived 10,000 years in the earth and then have by chance been discovered. That's a remarkable set of circumstances. So we only see a tiny, tiny part of what's happening in the past. I sometimes think it's like one in a million that we see. So to put together and try to understand past human behavior and past human subsistence and all these things we're interested in is a very long and complicated process. And the truth is that I think archaeology is only beginning to understand the variability that we're dealing with. And a wonderful example of this, in fact, comes from the ancient Near East, where agriculture was first invented. And the last 10 years, 15 years of archaeology in that area have completely changed our understanding of what happened in the origins of agriculture.
Well, let's talk about that invention of agriculture. What exactly had to happen for agriculture to be invented? When
does
it become
that? When I used that word, I thought I might get called on it. Mm-hmm. Because it's a tricky thing to describe, but I mean, people have often thought that humans in the past, if they discovered agriculture, they would jump at the chance to become farmers, to make life easier. But a lot of studies have demonstrated that, in fact, life becomes much more complicated. Diseases increase. The number of hours you have to work to get food increases. Things just get more complicated. So in fact, we think that people probably were forced to become farmers in some way or another. And there's a lot of theories about whether that was increasing population, more mouths to feed, or whether it was climate change that really hit hard.
Some bad hunting years.
Yeah, bad hunting years and a decrease in just the general biomass available. So that's a consideration. I tend to think that our ancestors prior to farming, knew how plants and animals reproduced. They understood how nature worked. And I don't think discovering how to put a seed in the ground and watch it grow was anything new at all. I think agriculture, again, was a series of changes that human society went through at this point in time. And invention or discovery or acceptance of agriculture are different ways we could talk about that event.
And how do you prove it? I mean, what sort of artifacts, what sort of evidence is there archaeologically?
There's two issues to separate, and that's the difference between domestication of plants and animals, which starts off this process, and agriculture itself. And domestication of plants and animals we can define by genetic or morphological, anatomical changes in the plants and animals. Those take place as humans start to change and control the reproduction of those species. Agriculture is more complicated because it involves all these non-plant and animal things I talked about. But we see it as we start to get bigger communities. We see it as we start to get much more long-distance trade and exchange and all kinds of raw materials. We see it in these non-food aspects of human society, I would say, that change so dramatically as agriculture takes off.
Well, the two would about have to overlap, wouldn't they? Because while you're planting next year's crop, you have to have something to eat, and that means hunting.
Absolutely. And I think we also tend to mischaracterize this shift to agriculture, you know. And I think we want to think that all of a sudden on a Tuesday 10,000 BC, everybody started farming all the time and stopped everything else they've been doing. In fact, agriculture seems to supply only 10 or 20% of the diet for much of the early part of this time period we're talking about. I mean, even in the Middle Ages in various parts of the world, wild foods have still been an important part of human diets. And, you know, in pioneer days in this country,
yes,
wild foods were also a very, very essential part. It's really only in the industrial era, I suspect, that domesticated plants and animals have dominated our diets.
So who do you see as our first farmers?
Well, these people in the ancient Near East and probably in China. Almost simultaneously, we see domestication of these plants taking place, and about the same time, domestication of early animals, and then this shift to bigger communities, more people.
How do they compare the first agriculture in China and in the Middle East or Europe?
What were they eating and growing?
Well, I'll take your question first. In the Near East, they've domesticated a lot of the basic staples that we use today: wheat, barley, chickpeas, lentils, flax, which is used for the oily seeds and for the fiber to make cloth. And they domesticated sheep and goats, pigs and cattle, among other species. Those are the sort of preeminent species. In China, they're domesticating millet in the north part of China. They're domesticating rice in the middle part of China. Probably a lot of root crops in the south of China. To compare the two areas is interesting but difficult. We know a lot about the Near East. That's where the most research has been done, and we just simply have more evidence. We don't know so much about China. The last 5 years, the age of the earliest agriculture domestication in China has been pushed back 1,000 years every year. So we're really just starting to learn a great deal about this process in China.
But the process of agriculture does have this westward drift from the Middle East into Europe? Is that fairly straightforward?
Absolutely. Absolutely. There's very clear evidence now of this sort of movement of farming, and I won't say farmers, I'll say farming, across Europe from the Middle East. Again, one of the really exciting pieces of evidence that's come to light in the last 15 years has been from Cyprus, the island of Cyprus, which is about 100 miles from the coast of Syria or Turkey, and has been the location where the earliest farmers, people contemporary with the earliest farmers in the mainland of the Near East, sailed across the Mediterranean to this island about 9,500 years ago. And they took with them, now at this time Cyprus was pretty barren. It had a species of mouse. It had a pygmy hippopotamus on the island. And that was about it. Okay, it was really...
Makes you wonder why they went there.
Well, that's a really good question. And what's really exciting is they took their whole ecosystem with them in these boats or canoes or whatever
they were planning.
They took cattle. They took sheep goats. They took pigs. They took red deer. They took foxes. They took a form of mouse, another species of mouse with them, probably accidentally. It was probably in the sacks of grain they were moving with them as well. And that movement to Cyprus doesn't seem to be spurred by high population density where they're coming from. It just seems like they picked up and left and went someplace new and took all their belongings with them. Now, this is exactly at the time when we have the earliest evidence for the domestication of those species that I mentioned. So in that sense, it's just remarkable. That starts the spread of agriculture westward. Okay, and then we seem to have two paths that it follows, one across the islands of the Aegean to Greece by about 7,000 BC, and then from central southern Turkey across the rest of Anatolia and then into Europe across the Straits of the Bosphorus. It's a fascinating sequence of events, and it's actually very rapid. That's one of the things that I find so fascinating is that the spread of agriculture, once it takes hold in the core area of the Near East, really moves very quickly, both east and west, in fact.
And as you're putting the story together and making determinations about the speed of how it spread and where it spread, are you looking at, I mean, I'm talking you in general, archaeologists in general, are they looking at bones of animals? Are they looking at pieces of pottery? What physical evidence are they?
Well, archaeologists look at everything today. We look at evidence that's molecular. We look at evidence that's atomic. We look at evidence that's on the standard artifact level of pottery and flint and the bones of animals that were eaten, the plant remains that are found in archaeological sites, the architecture that's present in places, the geology and environment in which these things sit. It's a body of evidence that archaeology is into today. And it's a very exciting field for that reason. There's so many lines of evidence being brought together to try and solve these problems.
So at the molecular level, because I mean most of us are familiar with bones and pots and all that, but let's say you're putting together the story of what happened in Cyprus and the fact that a new animal has arrived that wasn't there before.
Well, on Cyprus, the evidence is in the form of the bones of those animals found on the very early archaeological sites. But the molecular evidence is in the form of DNA now that's being extracted from these ancient bones and plant remains and being used to determine the place of origin for these species. So it's possible, for example, to say that all of the cattle that are found in Europe in early agricultural sites originated in the Near East. Their genetic lineage goes back to the Near East. So that in itself is a way of documenting the spread and the fact that this same breed of cattle, in a sense, was carried all the way across Europe.
Given that we're in Wisconsin, I have to ask the obvious dairy question.
Right, right.
It's one thing to raise beef cattle, but at what point did dairy cattle become a part of the equation, and what was the role of lactose intolerance?
Yeah, well, another very interesting question. The origins and antiquity of dairying have been a subject of concern recently, and it looks like that the antiquity of dairying now probably goes back just as early as the domestication of cattle. It's important to remember that cows are not the only source of milk, and other animals may have been milked as well. But there are certain kinds of artifacts that are starting to show up now which suggest that dairying was taking place.
And these three-legged stools?
It's more like sieves for making cheese. And the question of lactose intolerance enters here and where that genetic disposition for being able to digest milk comes from. And there is, in fact, some ancient DNA evidence now from humans in central Germany from an early Neolithic context, an early farming context, which suggests that that may have been the center of this lactose tolerance gene, which shows up in Germany and covers a lot of Scandinavia.
Lactose intolerance is the default.
Right.
Or it was.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So it goes back a long way and spread from Central Europe outward.
It does indeed, and it always makes me wonder, there's not an answer, whether these animals were domesticated for meat, these cattle were domesticated for meat, or whether they were domesticated for milk. And if people are lactose intolerant, then they must be already into cheeses and other forms of dairy products that you don't react to them if you're lactose intolerant. I don't know how you express that.
Is there any evidence that the spread of agriculture is tied to the rise of slavery or the presence of a sort of social hierarchy in which you have a laboring group?
You guys have got good questions. I just finished a paper with a good friend who works in the Near East on the origins of social inequality and the origins of agriculture. And we have a a sort of conventional picture of people prior to farming, prior to agriculture, as hunters and gatherers living on the wild and of the land and being very egalitarian, that everyone has the same rights and privileges and status, more or less, that positions of decision-making are ephemeral. They're based on achievement. If you're a good hunter or you're a curer or so forth, then in your lifetime you'll be recognized for that, but that recognition disappears when you're gone. And after the origins of agriculture, we do clearly see this emergence of status differentiation in human society, of elite individuals, of wealthy materials moving and being buried with a few people. So it's very clear that what we think of as ranking in human society or classes in human society are beginning to emerge after the origins of agriculture. So the question we're dealing with in this paper I mentioned is, are these things related? And of course I think they are. And of course I think that the emergence of social inequality is one of the phenomena that we're talking about as agriculture, that the total transformation of human social organization and economy and everything we do, basically, with the beginnings of farming and settled village life.
And specialization, too, I suppose, would increase if you have this community with a higher population from which to draw.
Absolutely, because we're probably talking about small groups of people on the order of 50 to 100 people before agriculture, and then we start to get groups of 1,000 or more people right at the origins of agriculture. So there's big changes happening.
What about irrigation? I'm assuming that when you're following agriculture, you're following the water.
That's true, but you have to think about where water is. And in the Near East, for example, everybody thinks about Mesopotamia as the birthplace of civilization, this land between two rivers, the Tigris and the Euphrates. But in fact, if you leave the riverbank on the Tigris and Euphrates, you're in desert, basically. There's less than a foot of rainfall a year in that region of Mesopotamia. So unless you irrigate in Mesopotamia, you can't grow a lot of food. Irrigation doesn't show up in the archaeological record until about 4,000 years after the origins of agriculture. Okay? So the origins of agriculture are taking place north of the Mesopotamian region, where the hills and mountains are higher and where the rainfall is above a foot a year, and when you can have much more natural vegetation. So that's an example of the importance of rainfall. Most of the early sites we see are located in places where there's a good bit of water available, either through natural springs or high water table deltas near rivers or on soils that are naturally more moist.
You have a pretty good climate difference, don't you, between the Near East where agriculture started and by the time you get into northwestern Europe?
Absolutely.
The crops must have varied considerably, even though the principles might have been much the same in producing them.
The crops vary in proportion a bit as to where we are in Europe. Much of southeastern Europe is not that different from Anatolia, from Turkey, for example. So that area, it doesn't show this big difference. But once you cross the Alps, you start to get into a very different kind of colder and wetter environment. And certainly, there may be some varietal changes in the major species of wheat and barley that are taking place that we can't see. But basically, the crops are the same. We see some shifts in the relative importance of wheat versus barley that appear to reflect dry conditions. Barley does better in dry conditions. But those basic staples are still the ones that are spreading.
Where does beer come in?
There's a very, very renowned archaeologist from the University of Chicago, Robert Braidwood, who's no longer with us. But Braidwood wrote a paper in the 50s arguing that beer was the reason for the origins of agriculture, that was the cause. And when I thought about this, I mean, I think it's very important too, because we have the same phenomena where I work in Scandinavia, where a lot of the early pottery that people are using with the beginnings of farming is designed to hold liquids. You know, now that could be milk, but it could also be beer, or it could be water, of course, too. And then I started worrying, well, most of the plants here are wheat, and there's not so much barley at the beginning. And I went and talked to the Brewers Institute on campus about this, not the Milwaukee Brewers, but there's a brewery research institute on campus. And they told me I was just slow, that wheat was just as good for making beer as barley.
They certainly use it a lot now.
Exactly. Exactly. Like the island wheat beer from Washington Island, right? Do you know that story?
No.
Oh, Washington Island had wheat farmers. And they were having trouble selling their crop. And somehow they got in contact with Capital Brewery here and started selling all their wheat to Capital Brewery. And they made this wheat beer that's so enormously popular. And now it's saved the wheat farmers on Washington Island, as I understand it. It's a good story anyway.
More on early agriculture when we continue in a moment with the University of the Year.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest, T. Douglas Price, who is enlightening us about the origins of agriculture in Europe. We know that it came from the Middle East and then it started spreading westward. But what was the sequence of agriculture in Europe? Who got it first?
Good question. We talked a little bit about Cyprus and how agriculture seems to have spread in a sort of two-pronged direction, one through by sea through the islands of the Aegean, Mediterranean to Greece, and another on the land bridge between Europe and Asia, between Turkey and Bulgaria, Romania. And the general picture for how that spread across Europe happened 20 years ago was based on a paper, a scientific paper by a geneticist and an archaeologist named Ammerman and Cavalli-Sforza from the 70s, who created a concept called demic diffusion. Demic just meaning people and diffusion just meaning spread. But they argued that there was a gradual and continuous spread of people from southeastern Europe, from Greece and the Balkan Peninsula, across the entire continent.
Colonizing Europe.
Farmers with their plants and animals moving steadily across that whole area.
No argument from the other Europeans?
Not so much, because the few radiocarbon dates, the absolute dates that we can obtain on this process, the few radiocarbon dates that were available at that time fit the model that they presented. They did show a gradual progression across the continent. And so they invoked ideas about population growing very rapidly and new lands that were empty. And it made a lot of sense. It's like all kinds of scientific thought at the time. It made a great deal of sense. But in the last 20 years, there has been a great deal more work done in Europe, probably 10 times more work than was done in the previous years for various reasons. And it's clear that demic diffusion model no longer applies. And what we have now, I think, is much more fascinating. And I would characterize the spread of humans into Europe now with agriculture as a series of jumps and stalls or leaps and stops, because we can see now that people spread very quickly, long distances, and stop and then sit there.
You mean stop and settle where they are?
Stop and settle and stay there for 1,000 years in some cases before they start another big spread to a new area.
Leaving the original place, you mean?
The original place remains as farming populations.
Oh, they leave population behind and move west.
Yep, exactly. Exactly. And we can see this as people move into the Balkans. We can see it as people jump along the Mediterranean, North Mediterranean coast. We can see it as people move into Central Europe and then into Scandinavia and the British Isles.
So is it our restless spirit or is there some other motivation?
Boy, I wish I knew the answer to that one.
No
but
evidence.
They're not farming out the soil, though, apparently.
Nope, that's not it, and it doesn't seem to be related to having to wait until plants adjust to new climate conditions and new hybrids are available to move into new environments. None of that really seems to apply.
Could it have nothing to do with agriculture, but just people wanting, you know, for religious reasons or for other reasons, you know, to find a new place?
I wish I knew the answer. What I can tell you is that where I work in Scandinavia, we think the reason that farming didn't come in there right away was because there were a lot of happy hunter-gatherers there to begin with. And they were very successful. They had a lot of food available. They had very rich fishing grounds and a lot of animals to hunt and lots of plants to eat. And maybe they just didn't buy into agriculture right away.
Short growing season too, though, if they had.
A short growing season, but after about 4,000 BC, agriculture spreads into that area within about 150 years, just jumps into that entire area. And these folks in southern Scandinavia knew about the farmers who were 100 kilometers, 60 miles south of them. They were trading with them. Okay, they were borrowing certain kinds of axes and certain kinds of ring designs and so forth, things we can see archaeologically. And they had to be in contact with them. They had to be exchanging things with them. But they didn't want those domesticated plants and animals, and they didn't want this set of things that seems to come with agriculture. It's a wonderful puzzle. It's a wonderful question as to why it takes this 1,000 years before they buy into that process.
Well, the Scandinavians still have this reputation of being kind of nomadic.
The same thing seems to happen in the British Isles. The same thing may be happening in other parts of interior Europe, where there's a delay, where there just seem to be more people who are already there and maybe just resistant to change.
Could it be – I mean, you're talking about this area that you've been working in, Scandinavia. Could it be that there are earlier farmers or equally early farmers in Africa, and it simply hasn't been discovered yet?
I'm not quite sure what you mean. If there were earlier farmers in Africa?
Well, if you're looking at how the first farmers are from the Near East or in China, mm-hmm. and then they spread across. I mean, a lot of this is coming from archaeological evidence that has been found from various digs. But I guess what I'm getting at is, could it be that whether it's in South America or Africa or other places, that there could be evidence if there were digs that we don't have, that the story may be more complicated.
That's an issue, but I don't think it's a major issue, because there has been some work done in most areas. And I think our general picture of the events involving the origins of agriculture are fairly well understood. So I don't think that's the reason we can't resolve this one. I mean, your first question involving human nature and just the sort of innate desire to move on and expand may be what's involved. Maybe it's a search for more raw materials or exotic things. To me, one of the most fascinating events in our entire human prehistory. I'm going to go off on a tangent here, but it's related to the human colonization of Australia. The earliest Australia was always at least 100 kilometers from the coast of Southeast Asia. You could not see it from Southeast Asia, okay? But sometime around 40,000 years ago, people went to Australia. Now, we didn't even know that people had a way to cross bodies of water 40,000 years ago. You know, I suppose you can lash some logs together, okay?
If you know where you're going.
Well, they couldn't have, presumably, okay? Yeah. And it also means that more than one person had to go. Somebody didn't just fall asleep on a log and drift off across the ocean. It had to be a male and a female, at least. And that implies intent. And why would you do that?
When you have all this land right there and not
right
that many people in
it. And you have no idea where you're going or if you'll ever come back.
Getting away from the in-laws? Or what
yeah.
What
I mean, I when I talk about this in my classes, I say I think this is related to why we go into space. I mean, there's all kinds of excuses for exploring space, you know, military purposes. And
but
you know,
really.
But really.
We just feel like it.
A lot of it is human curiosity. And this, I think we're born with this sort of innate need to explore.
Well, let me hop around, as long as we're doing that a little bit, and hop over to the New World for just a minute. When the American Indians in the Mississippi Valley went from a hunter-gatherer culture to an agricultural culture, their teeth suddenly went to hell.
Right.
All that sugar from the corn. Is that the kind of thing we see in Europe? What kind of changes do we see?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You can almost – if you find the skull of a hunter-gatherer in Europe and the skull of an agricultural person in Europe, you can look at the teeth and usually see that difference. It's very true. That's what I mentioned too, this, that the incidence of diseases and health problems really increases with the Neolithic. Now, part of that's probably related to just getting more people together in one place. Part of it's related to the fact that a number of our diseases originate in various species of animals. Like, I think it's tuberculosis that originated in cattle somehow. So if you live – I don't bank on this, but if you live with cattle, then you're liable to see a transmittal of that of disease somehow. There's a number of incidences of diseases like that. So I think that's all related to what we see in health conditions.
So the hunter-gatherers actually were more robust and healthier.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You can look at the thickness of the bone in legs and arms of hunter-gatherers, for example. They're much, much heavier, thicker bones.
Thoreau writes that men are not the keepers of herds, that herds are the keepers of men. You had mentioned, too, that there are these negatives with agriculture, that you become, in a sense, enslaved to the process itself.
Jared Diamond, our Guns and Steel man, once asked the question, was agriculture the worst mistake that humans ever made? Yeah, I think that's a great exaggeration. And again, I have a great appreciation for farmers because I couldn't be sitting here talking to you if we didn't have an agricultural society. It supports everything else we do, and it's responsible, the origins of agriculture and why I think it's so important. It's responsible for our way of life today in terms of, again, almost every aspect of human society.
Do you see early evidence of bartering? You know, once you've got people growing things, do you see exchange?
We see some exchange before agriculture, usually short-distance, small-scale kinds of things. With the beginnings of agriculture in the Near East, for example, there are all kinds of exotic stone materials and adhesive materials like bitumen, which start to be traded over very long distances. And I think that must reflect this importance of higher-level economic systems in agricultural societies. We also see rare and exotic things being moved around, and I think that reflects this social inequality, these status differences that I mentioned too. There is a glassy volcanic material known as obsidian. It's a beautiful black glass that forms in sand deposits near volcanoes. And it's the best material on Earth for making sharp stone tools. And people in the past loved it. So it was traded over very long distances. But some of this obsidian was polished. A nodule of obsidian could be polished with a concave surface, and it would act like a mirror. You could see yourself in that concave surface in that black glass. And this would have been presumably one of the first times people were beginning to see their reflections. It must have been a really special artifact.
Must have been some really interesting faces.
Exactly. Exactly. And that object starts to be traded and moved over long distance. And you have to imagine that grinding a concave—
It's a luxury item.
Absolutely. It would take a lot of time and effort.
So we're talking about – if we're talking about Europe, Cyprus, 9,500 years ago.
Yep. A little more.
By the time we get to Denmark, what, about 4,000 years ago?
6,000, yep.
6,000.
Yep.
So yep. 3,500 years to cover Europe with agriculture.
Exactly, yeah. Sounds like a long time, but it's not.
Do you see religious responses, for example, with the ancient Greeks and Romans, and you've got gods and goddesses of the harvest and
so on? Again, I would take us first back to the Near East, and again, discoveries in the last 15 years that are just mind-boggling. There is a site called Göbekli Tepe in Turkey now that is, again, as old as Cyprus, the Neolithic early farming on Cyprus, and as old as the beginnings of animal domestication, where there are – the only way to describe them is as temples. They're built on a hilltop where people wouldn't live because people live in well-watered places. They are dug into the ground about 9 to 10 feet. They are on the order of 40, 50, 60 feet in diameter, circular structures. And they have these enormous stone columns holding up a roof on these buildings. If you saw these, you would think they were Greek or Roman, or you would think they were from a much later period of time because of the scale and the intensity of work. The animal bones that are found around these structures are mostly of wild cattle. It suggests that people are feasting in these places. It's very different from what you see in a small village, for example. These are clearly very special. Religion may be too strong a word. We could call them ritual or ceremonial places for these people. And it's clearly a place that a lot of people got together to build. It's not just a handful of people who dig these huge holes and cut these stone pillars and raise the roof on these structures. So it's a very different picture of just small groups of people eking out an existence in the landscape.
Do we start to see then with agriculture architecture?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, there are some instances of small-scale architecture before agriculture, but very limited, really. And with agriculture, you get much an order of magnitude difference in the kinds and scale of construction.
That and in Europe, we start to see what rectangular houses.
You get some very big, some of the largest structures in Europe with the origins of agriculture are enormous longhouses made of massive timbers, buildings that are 100 feet long or more in some cases.
Habitation or warehouses or both?
They're probably – it looks like they're divided into three parts. And it looks like one part is residence and one part is cattle beers or animal stalls. And the other part may be storage for wheat, barley, cereals and other things.
So anything that looks remotely like a barn or a silo?
There are silos, absolutely, both in the Near East and in parts of Europe. Barns – you know, because my picture of a barn is a big, great big building somewhere painted red. And we don't see those until a good bit later in time. Usually we see these sort of combined residence and farming structures in one building.
Let's get a better look at what these people were actually eating when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air.
I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is T. Douglas Price from the Department of Anthropology, and we're talking about early agriculture, Europe's first farmers. I'm curious about the work you do, that your lab does, you know, what you actually find and what you're working with.
Well, it does apply to the spread of agriculture in Europe. We've been, for the last 20 years now, looking at isotopes in human teeth and trying to learn about movement in the past, how people moved in the past.
Can you help me with that term, isotope in human teeth?
Sure. Isotopes are different forms of the same element, different atomic forms of the same element. And we've been focusing on the element strontium and its isotopes because strontium isotopes vary with geology, with the kind of rock in which they're found.
And they're very persistent, are they not?
They are. They are very, very old in some cases. And that's one of the things that affects the ratio. The older the rock, the higher the ratio of strontium isotope would be, one way to think about it. Now, the good part about that is that these isotopes or this element strontium goes from rocks, and the rock degrades into soils, and soils provide the nutrients for plants, and animals and people eat those plants, and those isotopes get into us. And strontium is deposited 99% in our skeletons. It's not much in soft tissue. And in our teeth, strontium is also incorporated as the enamel forms, and that enamel only forms at birth. It only really forms in the first few years of life, except for your third molar, which is a little bit later. So the strontium isotopes in your teeth contain the geology, the signal of the geology from where you're born, from those first few years of life. If you leave that geology and go to a different geology, another place, we can compare your tooth enamel signature, strontium, to the local geology. And if it's different, you must have come from another place. It's a very simple and very, very effective technique. So we thought, let's look at these first farmers moving into Europe. And we examined a group in the central part of Europe, in Germany.
Now you're talking about skeletal remains?
Right, absolutely. These folks have been dead for 7,500 years.
I guess I'm amazed that they'd still be preserved well enough to work with.
In Germany, at least, these sites are found in a silt, a loess. Actually covers parts of Wisconsin, too. And that tends to preserve the skeletal remains. So we can find the bones and teeth of those folks. So we do find the preserved skeletons and teeth of these individuals, and we can measure the strontium isotope ratio in the tooth enamel. And what we've done is to take a series of early burials from this time period, from this early farming period in Germany, and compare the signature in the tooth to the local place where they're buried. And we find that between about 10% and about 50% of the individuals are buried in places where they were not born.
How far away? I mean, how far do we go?
Well, that's a good question. And right now we prefer just to say they're not local because the same geology with the same strontium isotope signature can crop up in a number of different places. So it's difficult to say for sure. For example, in Germany, the Black Forest is a very old rock formation. And there's another identical age rock formation to the north of Heidelberg. Okay, and we can't say whether
which one
they would come from. So I prefer not to try and pin it down. We're trying some other work to see if we can isolate those differences.
Are you working with animals at all, too, to see if they move?
Yeah, we do. We try and see if cows are moving, for example, and we try and see if they're being taken up to summer pasture in mountainous rock, Rocky Mountains, for example. I have a project we're doing in the North Atlantic to study the first Icelandic peoples using strontium isotopes and the first people to Greenland and see where they're coming from. And we measured some cows as well, and it's pretty clear that about half the cows we look at on Greenland were brought there from Iceland.
That probably makes sense, though.
Would you expect that? When you look back on it, I think hindsight, it does make more sense. But it was a very high proportion. I was surprised it was about half of them. But no, we haven't looked at a lot so far, but that's what we're seeing.
And the cows from Iceland coming
from
where?
The cows from Iceland are born on Iceland.
They are?
Yeah. Yeah.
But you can't tell where the first cows
came from? The chances of us finding the remains of the very first cows that came to Iceland are, again, probably one in a million.
So you're talking about medieval, probably.
This is Viking period. Early medieval, yeah. Depending on where you are.
So are there any record holders where you can say, well, this guy really moved all the way across Europe during his lifetime?
Well, we're looking at a settlement in the Dominican Republic called La Isabela, which is a town that Columbus founded in 1494, the first European town in the New World. And he took a bunch of folks off one of the ships, a bunch of sailors, and told them they were going to live there and start a town. And there were a couple of hundred people, I think. Now, most of them were ill from scurvy and travel when they got off the boat. A number died right away. And over the next 2 years, almost all the rest of them died. And they're buried in a cemetery on that island.
Fairly recently discovered, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. The Italian government decided in 1990 that they would celebrate the 500th anniversary of Columbus and go excavate this town. And they did and dug up the skeletons from the cemetery. And we've been analyzing the teeth now of those folks. So they're from quite a ways away. We also found evidence, very clear evidence, I think, of the first Africans in the New World in cemeteries in Mexico. The area that those folks are coming from in Africa is very old rock. And the signature is so high, the value is so high that we never see it in the New World in Mexico.
Now, what has made you so fascinated with Scandinavia? You've done quite a bit of excavating there.
Yeah. Well, I did my early research in the Netherlands and liked European archaeology very much. There's a lot of information and a lot of work going on for many years. But I knew the preservation of bones and plant remains and other materials was better in Scandinavia, in Denmark particularly.
You have a lot of those bogs, for one thing.
Exactly. You know about the bog people. So that was part of the fascination. And so I started working there to get better evidence in a way.
And what kind of things did you find that made you keep wanting to come back?
Well, we found a lot of different organic materials, pieces of wood, pieces of early dugout canoes, pieces of decorated antler. The site we've been excavating most recently, we found something like 30 bone fish hooks from a hunting and gathering site, which is an extraordinarily high number for the kind of work we do. So there's just a lot of excitement in the variety that's provided by this good preservation.
What are you looking for?
I'm trying to understand the spread of agriculture to Scandinavia, and I'm trying to find sites that date to this period around 4000 BC to try and see if we can determine what's changing in how people were getting their food, the kind of food they were getting, how they were living generally. What happens when farming comes into this area in terms of human behavior?
When does that Danish ham start to appear?
I don't know, but there were an awful lot of acorns and hazelnuts around for those pigs to eat, so I'm sure the meat was very good. Actually, there are wild boar in this region before domesticated pigs come in, and these hunters and gatherers were hunting those animals in large numbers. So they had wild ham, which was probably really good even before agriculture comes.
So what kind of actual communities do we have, if we're talking in terms of agricultural communities? These tend to be a lot of people living in a single dwelling or two, or virtual villages with fields outside.
I think the village picture is a better one, and people seem to be living in households rather than in groups. Individual households, extended families might be a model for the groups of people who occupy these households. The field systems we don't know a lot about in the earliest part of this beginning of farming. Later on, we can see the fields still in the ground in some places. But in the beginning, it seems that agriculture is only a small part of what people are doing. Again, like I mentioned, 10-20% of the food they're eating. So the field systems may not have been so extensive, and the numbers of animals they were keeping may not have been great either.
So playing out the soil was not an issue. They had small enough fields that they could move if they needed to.
It seems to be the case. It may also be the case that they were rotating crops, because they do have some nitrogen fixing lentils and so forth in their crop complex, that they may have been able to do that. There's no evidence that they're exhausting soils, particularly in Northern Europe.
How are they planting it? They weren't plowing at this point, were they?
Not at the very earliest part of the Neolithic. We start to see traces of ards in the earth in the later part of the Neolithic, but at the moment there's no clear evidence. They may be in wetter, softer soils as well, perhaps where a digging stick would work or some kind of furrowing device, simple kind of a plow, but we don't see the evidence for that.
I would guess that another thing you would see if you start to get these agricultural communities, especially those with a degree of luxury items, you'd have to start seeing some defensive procedures and precautions.
It depends on where we are in the world. Very interesting, in southern Scandinavia, where I work, the incidence of violence in human skeletons before farming is higher than that incidence after farming arrives.
Can we tell if this is human against human?
It's certainly human against human. It's people being bashed in the head by axes and clubs. It's people being shot with arrows. There's an awful lot of traumatic injury in the pre-farming period. Now, that's not to say it disappears in the early farming period, but it certainly decreases.
Are most of the victims of this violence men, or is it a more general pattern?
Nope.
No, women are also part of it.
Families. There's a fascinating cemetery excavated in the 70s outside of Copenhagen with 20-some individuals buried. And there are graves with a man and a woman and child in them. There are graves with a woman and her baby in them. There are graves with just males or just females in them. There's another grave to the south of Copenhagen with, I think it's 12 individuals and a mass grave from this period, all probably killed in this violent time.
This sounds like warfare then, rather than a one-on-one argument.
I think it's probably something like a raiding among villages where people are going out and whacking their neighbors, basically.
And we see less violence then when there's agricultural
settlement. There seems to be less skeletal evidence for violent injury in the first part of the Neolithic. Now, that starts to increase again after that. But at the very beginning, it's not as pronounced.
You have any idea why? I mean, why would it be any different?
I really don't, because as I mentioned earlier, I think the amount of food and the resources available in this area were abundant in the pre-farming period. So I can't imagine that people are really fighting over territory or other things. I don't know what people were fighting about, and I hate to think it's inherent in human nature.
At what point do we actually start to see these things that keep turning up in Europe in much later sites, you know, the worked gold?
Metallurgy in any form, early copper, later bronze, and gold comes in with copper, really, starts to show up in the later part of the Neolithic, in fact. And there's some extraordinary sites with gold in graves in Bulgaria, for example, which date again to about 5,000 BC, so quite early.
And we're starting to see then at that point not just this class distinction, but this distinction that really elevates individuals to the status of having these fantastic tombs.
Certainly in Bulgaria at this time, there are a couple of individuals buried with an enormous amount of wealth and just so different from everybody else in the cemetery that they must have been very special individuals.
With all of these new scientific techniques, how important is it actually to dig? anymore.
Well, you're asking the right person. I said, a few years ago that I think the major discoveries in archaeology in the future are going to come from the laboratory rather than the field. And that's an exaggeration because I love the lab work that we do. And there will be some very, very interesting field discoveries. But the work that's going on in laboratories at the molecular, at the atomic level is really opening not just new windows but new doors on the past. And I think ancient DNA, I think isotopic work that's going on, I think some of the work with satellite surveys and so forth is just going to revolutionize our understanding of the past. And I think understanding our past is so important. I think that archaeology has an enormous contribution to make to not just human knowledge, which is always a good justification for what we do, but to really understanding where we are today and the things we face. I mean, people in the past faced climatic change and they faced conflicts and they faced all kinds of problems. If we want to understand how to deal with global warming today, for example, we might look at how people in the past dealt with major climatic changes that took place over the last 10, 15,000 years and beyond.
They didn't just move?
They didn't always have that choice. In many cases, they died. In Greenland, for example,
famous case. Yeah, they couldn't adapt, could they?
They couldn't handle the little ice, beginnings of the little ice age.
If I remember that story correctly, they couldn't bring themselves to eat more fish and less mutton.
Exactly, exactly. It's a fascinating story. And the cattle died in their beers in the barns in Greenland because there wasn't enough fodder to feed them. It's a remarkable story. And people just wouldn't change.
More stories to be found when we dig them up or our archaeologists do it for us.
Our guest has been T. Douglas Price, and we've been talking about Europe's first farmers, the origins of agriculture. I'm Emily Auerbach, and I hope you can join Norman Gilliland and me for the next hour of University of the Year.